Well, we covered an awful lot of stuff yesterday. And maybe if we were going to try and wrap our arms around what we had talked about, we would probably say that one of the themes that we addressed was the idea that Islam is often not well understood by us. And that because we don't understand it in a very basic way, we make an awful lot of mistakes about it. Those mistakes extend into public life, so in terms of our politics and diplomacy. They often extend into cultural matters or our interactions with Muslims themselves, and they certainly involve the church. How does Christianity, for example, interact with Islam? How does it respond to Islam? One of the things we said yesterday was Islam was an expansive religion. It's an evangelistic religion at its core. That's the very root of what it is. So if it is, basically speaking, evangelistic religion, and we are, basically speaking, as Christians, also an evangelistic religion, and we don't share the same theology, then that means that somewhere, somehow, we're actually headed in, right into one another. So questions often are, what do you do about that? Right? What's my response supposed to be? If Islam is teaching something dramatically different than I believe, then how do I best respond to it? Maybe if I want to take it one step beyond that, where's the gospel in this? Right? How do I promote the gospel in the face of Islam? How do I promote the gospel to Islam? We talked about, I think, is a growing concern, which is a growing number of evangelicals that take, I think, in many ways, a very deficient view of Islam in the sense that they're too soft on it. We try to accommodate it as much as we can with the purpose of pursuing a dialogue which we hope will lead to more understanding and so on. And, as I tried to tell you yesterday, the idea of relationships and friendships with Muslims is wonderful. I'm all for that, and I have had that. But the way in which evangelicals are often pursuing dialogue doesn't go where they think it's going to go. It doesn't promote the gospel in the way that it should. So we make a lot of mistakes. At the heart of that is we don't really get quite what Islam really is. One of the things we said yesterday was that Islam is a pre-modern system of life. I mean, it's a pre-modern religion. It's a pre-modern culture. Christianity is too. And in one of the things we said yesterday was that in these pre-modern ideas, our politics, our religion, our culture, all of those things and personal lives fuse together. They're integrated. That one of the problems with the modern world that we're all a part of is the modern world over-specializes and it fragments things up. So that someone will study the political aspects of Islam or the religious aspects of Islam or the cultural aspects, anthropological aspects of it. Or they'll look at Islam in this place or that one or that one or that one. But by doing that, sometimes you lose the forest for the trees. You actually miss what it is because you're so specialized you don't get to seeing how it all works together. So we've tried to do that. One of the things that I said, I tried to say it in a low-key kind of way, but I don't know of any books that actually say this, I'm becoming rather convinced that Islam, which followed Judaism and Christianity, has far less to do with Christianity than it does to do with Judaism. In other words, that a model for Islam can be found more within the Jewish faith as it was found in the early church, for example, in that period of time, than it would be in Christianity. That if I was going to look for a model for Muhammad, it would not be in Jesus. If you that's a simple test. You know, if you know anything at all about Muhammad's life, his story, and that's all readily available. And then compared to Jesus, you don't. There's not really much to talk about. But it's interesting because you look at the, you know, this is some artist's idea of what Joshua looked like. This is more has more in common, or Moses has more in common with who Muhammad modeled himself after, and their faith modeled itself after than Christianity. Let me see if I can prove that to you. It's interesting that, you know, within, I mean, the center of the Muslim world is Mecca, right? Everybody knows that. But Mecca was the last place, the last major place in the Arabian Peninsula that Islam had to conquer. So it sort of became their capital, but the place where Islam became Islam was not in Mecca. The place Islam became Islam was in Medina, or it used to be called Yathrib. Same place. It was in Medina, which was a Jewish city, that the political apparatus, the military apparatus, the pietism, and the legalism of Islam is all rooted. It's rooted in Medina. I don't think it's coincidental that Medina was a majority Jewish city. You can see in the Quran that there are sections of the Quran that are militantly anti-Jewish. And you can understand the reason for it, because the principal opponents of Muhammad and his authority were Jews in Medina. And that it was in Medina that perhaps the worst atrocity Muhammad committed personally was done. Where 600 to 900, we're not sure of the numbers, 600 to 900 males were beheaded, Jewish males, where the women and children were all sold into slavery, where their land was confiscated, and the Jewish tribes in the surrounding area, while they weren't forced to convert at the time, were basically meant to work for the Muslims. They had to give half of everything they produced to the Muslims. So I guess what I'm getting at is that if you want to look for the birthplace of Islam, it's not Mecca. That's the last place. I mean, Mecca in a way is the center of Islam because it was their big triumph, not because it started there. It really started in Medina. In Medina, Muhammad became the warrior. He became a prophet. He became a judge, which is very interesting because that's exactly true of some of our Old Testament figures as well. Syriac Christians, so Christians from Syria, and you have to remember at the birth of Islam that Syria was Christian. That was the only religion in Syria. Syriac Christians saw Muhammad as an interpreter of the Torah. I have a chronicler writing about it who believed that Muhammad, he didn't understand him as a warrior or anything. He actually saw him as somebody who was a student of the Old Testament, of the Torah. Isn't that interesting? I think it's interesting. It's interesting if I think it's interesting. It's just interesting, you know. Ask my wife. Torah is the same thing as the Torah. I mean, what Muslims would call a Torah. We say Torah, or you can say Torah. It's all the same deal. So Muhammad was actually a student of the first five books of the Old Testament. That was the opinion of Christians at the time. So they didn't. It's kind of interesting too, because Christians at the time didn't think that he was some kind of a Christian. If they knew, if they were putting him in a category, one of the categories they thought that was likely to place him in was maybe some kind of a Jew, not necessarily some kind of a Christian. It's interesting that when the Muslims built the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, they saw it as a replacement for the temple in Jerusalem. Interesting. Now, if you think about this for a minute, it's also interesting because if you look at Joshua in this little picture over here, who is poised on the edge of the river as he's gathering his people to go into Canaan, I believe that it's somewhat analogous to Muhammad, who was perched on the edge of the Arabian Desert, ready to head north and east and west. That was his model. There's an intense pietism. And you all know this with the praying five times a day and fasting during Ramadan and going on a Hajj during your lifetime and having to pay for charity and all of that stuff. All of that is a kind of pietism and a kind of legalism. And in that way, it's very similar to Jewish kinds of piety in the centuries following Jesus' crucifixion. There's a lot of similarities to these things. You remember yesterday I called it a fork in the road, and that Christianity went down one fork? It's an interesting question at the Council of Jerusalem in Acts 15. What would have happened if the church didn't make the decision it made to accept in the Gentiles as they were, to not make the law a kind of hedge or boundary as it had been functioning? What if the new faith had become a kind of Jewishness that became international? Just an interesting question. If you took all that Jewish piety and legalism and then you sent it out. In some ways, I think that's kind of what happened with Islam. Just like the Judaism of the time, which is attested to in all kinds of writing. Early Islam, just like Judaism, is extremely anti-Trinitarian from the beginning. There was never any suggestion that Muslims would ever accept Trinity. Never. So I think perhaps it is. Maybe Islam is what a militant, expansive Judaism might have looked like. And in those early days, Muhammad was trying to get everybody's approval, you know. He wanted the Jews, he didn't just persecute them to start with. He came to them as a prophet, assuming they would accept him into their tradition, or in that sense, basically, he would absorb them into his new tradition. They'd all be part of the same faith. It's also true that in the early period of Islam, Muslims didn't call themselves Muslims yet. It took a few years for that to develop. They called themselves believers because they saw themselves in continuity with, not simply in contrast to, the earlier religions. In its truest sense, Islam's always thought that it was the fulfillment of, the successor to, Judaism and Christianity, both of which had received earlier revelations from God. And now Muhammad was receiving the last and best, the final revelation. But in order to do that, you don't actually have to do something entirely new. You just have to take what was done earlier and drag it a little further forward, which is really what he did. So what I said yesterday makes sense. Judaism was a covenantal religion. It was a religion established by God in covenant with the people that he chose. Christianity picked up that same motif and enlarged it. Muhammad also picked up that covenantal idea that they were the people of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and as you see on the screen there, that you just add Ishmael to it. Right? You can't leave him out. Who's the biblical star of the Quran? Jesus, 31 times. Mary, she's about 50. She has more occurrences in the Quran than Jesus does. Who's the star? Moses is the star. These are the major surahs that actually deal with Moses' life. But if you total them up, I think it's 133 occurrences. So there are more than twice as many references to Moses as there is to Jesus. By the way, that woodcut there, that's Moses blessing Joshua. In spite of the fact that Islam came out of its background, emerging as another covenantal religion, but seeing itself as the covenantal religion. You remember, you know, the picture in Romans of the church as an olive tree? This is a picture of this olive tree, which is almost like this covenantal structure. Growing up through the Old Testament with branches that are Jewish and Gentile. And that there are dead branches that are cut off and Gentile branches that are grafted in, and there are other living branches that are Jewish branches. They're all part of the same tree, covenantal structure. Islam posits itself as the tree. It's the tree. It's not a branch in an older tree. It's the true tree. Because it sees Judaism and Christianity as corrupting their original given messages, it presents itself as that true tree of God growing up and spreading all over the world. Because it sees itself exclusively as the true religion, there are unbridgeable distinctions between it and any other faith system and any other people. See, that explains a phenomenon. When you go into, with the exception of Iranians, when you go into Western Europe, for example, if you're in France or in Germany or in England, you're in Belgium, there is a tendency, and it's true for all immigrants, but I think that there's something added because of the religion that Muslims tend to stick together. It's interesting that the head of Turkey would make the statement you see there. Assimilation is a crime against humanity. I don't know if you hadn't had enough coffee yet. Just think about that statement for a minute. A crime against humanity? That's a little harsh, isn't it? Assimilation. So if my people assimilate into the rest of the people. So if I move my 100 people into Billings, Montana, if I assimilate into the Billings culture, that's a crime against humanity? But you understand the attitude then. In Germany, though, you have, I think, around 4 million Turkish Muslims. The young lady in the picture there is a German Turk. She maintains her Turkish identity, her Turkishness. And the point is not so much what she wants to do, but the fact that the whole Muslim world around her, reaching all the way back from Turkey into Germany, wants her to stay separate. It wants her to have a distinct identity that does not get lost in the German culture. When I lived in London, I went out with a Muslim convert, Pakistani, and he and I started these kind of Bible study groups. I mean, it was an outreach group. And the way we did it was we visited every mosque in the western part of London we were in called Southall, which is mostly Indians and Pakistanis. So we'd visit these imams, and we would get their permission to invite people from their mosques to attend these meetings, mixes of Christians and Muslims that were not there for dialogue. We would look at either a specific issue or a specific thing from one of either from the Bible or the Quran and argue about it, basically. We had several people converted from it. The mosques that turned us down were mosques that thought that any contact with us would defile them. And it wasn't hard to know, because when you went in and visit the mosque director, if they have one, or the imam, if he doesn't shake your hand, it's not a good sign. Now, most of the time they did. And we had loads of people come and visit and join the group, and we baptized some people out of our study. But fact remained that there were people that wouldn't do it because they felt that they needed to remain apart. Your identity takes you somewhere. So if you go back to the roots of Islam, if you go back to who it sees itself as, is this giant global family, this covenantal family that's on a mission. To be part of that family doesn't mean you're always even aware of the agendas and the trajectory. You're just living. But you go along with the flow of it. Let's talk about the creation and the instincts of what became an imperial religion. I think Ephraim Karsh is not far off when he says that we have a clash of empires, not civilizations. There is one sense in which Islam grew imperially. It grew as empires. That's where the vast majority of its growth took place. There are still some people out there in the Islamic world that would like to revive that. I would say probably most Muslims I know aren't looking for an empire, but they do have an expectation that they'll grow in a way that was true when they were empires. The picture in there are of Janissaries. I mentioned yesterday Janissaries were Turkish kind of elite troops, shock troops, and they really weren't Turkish. They were actually Christian boys kidnapped when they were very young, raised as fanatical Muslims, and then used as frontline troops in conquering Christian lands. So how did Islam grow? At the very earliest parts of Islam, it grew by raiding and preaching in tandem. So you could have a sword in one hand and a Quran in the other hand. Everything was coordinated and went together. For example, in Christianity, there's a great debate within Christian faith over whether force is ever a legitimate option. Can someone, is pacifism the best alternative? Is there an alternative for self-defense? Those are the questions we ask. Islam has no question like that. There is nothing in the Quran or in any of the Islamic writings that hints at pacifism. It doesn't exist. And it doesn't exist because from the very beginning, it didn't see the two as antithetical. That your religious faith went along with your expansion. And the expansion meant not just reaching people's minds, but also putting them under submission. So politics and religion were not separated. Now that does create some problems for us in the modern world, doesn't it? Because we generally do. Europeans and Americans in particular do, because we're all sort of the survivors of religious wars back in the 16th and 17th centuries that killed millions of people. So we're trying to avoid repeating that. So we separated church and state in the way we did, partly as a reaction and maybe even an overreaction to that. Islam's never had that kind of occurrence. The instinct from the earliest parts of Islam was conquest. From the very year that Muhammad died. And even before that, to conquer within the Arabian Peninsula. The idea is you get on the offense and you keep it. Now, you should remember that, because when we're talking about a common word between us and stuff like that, notice how it happened. It was Muslims taking the initiative to tell Christians what they should be doing. In a peaceful way. Nevertheless, the whole purpose, a deliberate purpose, was to take the initiative. I would say, my own experience, and historically speaking, Muslims had the hardest time when they don't have the initiative. When somebody else does. When they're on the defensive, it's difficult for them because they don't expect to be that way. They expect to be in the offense. From the earliest periods of Islam, you use the dual tactics of offering carrots and delivering sticks. What you try to do is, when you come into a land and occupy it, you try to divide the resistance. You divide the resistance in part by buying off part of it. You offer people good positions. You don't impose too heavy a hand immediately, so that the people that you conquer, in the case of early Islam, the Christians, start arguing with one another over what to do about you. Because the more indecision there is, the better you are. Long term, what you do is you implement structures that will coercively work in your favor. You don't have to conquer everything, and you don't have to convert everybody with a sword. It's not necessary. You can do it nice and slow. If you look at the history of the conquest, I mean, do you have any idea how long it took before more than 50% of the populations of these conquered lands became Muslim? The average is 275 years. Now, that's a lot when you think about it. How old is the United States? All right, so it took longer than we've been around for a country to go more than 50% Muslim. At the very beginning, when Syria and what became known as Lebanon and Iraq, those were staunchly Christian for hundreds of years. They had Muslim minorities ruling very large Christian majorities, but they would whittle away at it. The Christians became comfortable in one sense with being Dhimmi people. Dhimmi means the people of obligation. What that means is that Muslims say that once they conquer a people, they are under obligation to protect you. I call it, you know, because I come from Queens, I call it a protection racket, because that's what it was. We're really protecting you from ourselves. So if you pay a poll tax, if you let us take some of your kids, if you don't mind not being able to ride a horse, you weren't allowed to ride a horse, if you're not allowed to own a weapon like a sword, if you don't mind dressing differently than the rest of us, if you mind not holding any positions other than the ones that we make available for Christians, if you don't mind moving into the ghettos that we furnish for you, we'll protect you. That's what it means to be a Dhimmi people. People get used to being protected in that way, because that becomes how you survive. In a little while, we're going to talk about a missionary methodology that I think is causing a great deal of harm. It's interesting, though, that if you look at the roots of the idea, some of them do come from the Middle East, and that there were Protestant Christians in the late 1930s proposing the same things that we're now playing around with all over the world. But those Protestants coming out of the Middle East were dimming people. So they were proposing methodologies for missionaries based on survival. And that, on its face, can't ever really be right, because evangelism is actually based on Jesus wins. I mean, well, you come right down to the simple fact of it, that's what it's based on, right? It's not whistling in the wind, you know, that's not what evangelism is. We have this, sorry to use a big word, eschatological, you know, we're looking forward to what God is going to do, what Jesus is going to do. When you have a dhimmi attitude, then the greatest reality in your life is Islam. Islam is perpetual. Islam will never disappear. Islam is permanent. And because it is, you have to learn how to live with it. That's called being a dhimmi person. Another feature of Islam comes right out of its creation is perpetual jihad. Now, jihad has been argued over in the Muslim world since the very beginning, over whether that meant using the sword or polemically arguing or a spiritual struggle. It's actually all of the above. The use of terror today is a manifestation of jihad. In classic Muslim theology, jihad is a perpetual state. In other words, jihad's always here. That doesn't mean we're always at war, but there's always an us and there's always a them. And because there is, there's always a struggle. Liberal Muslims today try to make that more of an internal thing, saying, I have a spiritual struggle. But that's rather foreign to Muslim theology. Muslim theology doesn't really have this inner struggle thing very much. It's mostly an external thing. And finally, and maybe the most important point, is right at the bottom of the page, that word dawah. Everything is witness. Everything is meant to push the ball forward. Everything. Every dialogue you have. Every meal that you share. Every bit of hospitality, every argument, every tract you write, every war you fight, everything is witness. Now that means that what conflict with non-Muslims is like is not always a bloody business. But it does mean that when you author a common word between us and you, it's part of your witness. There's no such thing as dialogue for its own sake. We're dialoguing for a purpose. I remember when I was teaching history in Alabama, one of our faculty members invited a professor from the American University in Cairo, who was an observant Muslim, a pretty hardcore Sharia guy, not violent at all. He was not into revolutions and whatever, but he was in. He did believe that the heaven on earth model would be the Sharia. He got invited by the American because they wanted an honest and open dialogue between Muslims and Christians. And Samford University in Birmingham was started by Alabama Baptists, so it has Christian origin to it. So basically, here's a guy who's a professing Christian inviting a Muslim from Cairo to come and have an honest dialogue. I warned him. I said, if you want to invite him, go ahead, but don't invite him because you're going to have an honest dialogue. I can tell you what's going to happen. You're going to give him 50 minutes. He's going to take all of that time, and he's going to use it to proselytize you. That's his purpose. And that's exactly what happened. We only had an open and honest dialogue when I took him to a Chinese restaurant for lunch, and he was having problems with his kids. And I was able to interact with him as a Christian parent talking to a Muslim parent, and I got to pray for him, and I shared the gospel with him, because we changed the setting. But as soon as he heard the word dialogue, he was going, dawah. it's my chance to witness. When Bill invites Imad to go to lunch, that's also dawah, but it got turned around. Islam believes at its core that it is the real civilization. That the rest of the world is a world of unbelief. Now, it's a funny thing because Muslims believe theologically that everyone is born a Muslim. You and I were all born Muslims. And it's through ignorance primarily that we weren't raised Muslim as we should have been, so we never learned. But everybody in Billings, Montana, everybody out on the Crow Reservation was a Muslim at birth. And the imperative is to bring you back into the fold, because that's where you'll find what life is supposed to be all about. So Islam is a great civilization. Here's a long quote by one of the two founders, really, of the Islamic Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood. Only Islam is the distinction of basing the fundamental binding relationship in its society on belief. So he's writing between the 1920s and 1940s, and he's saying that we're the only people on earth that base our whole society on our religious beliefs. Everybody else is secularized. Black and white, red and yellow, Arabs, Greeks, Persians, Africans, all nations which inhabit the earth become one community. You know, if you left this story right there, you can understand why they think they're civilized. Wouldn't it be wonderful? I mean, you have all people together like that? I mean, that's a very civilized picture of life. It's even a biblical picture of life, to be honest about it. In this society, God is the Lord, and only He is worshipped. The most honorable is the one who is noblest in character. All individuals are equally subject to a law which is not man-made, but made by their Creator. What's wrong with that? So at some level, that appeal that comes out of their identity is not a bad thing, is it? It's interesting, he's behind bars, and the same man is also a guy that wanted a counter-terrorism campaign in Egypt in the 1940s. Same person. Here he is again. Islam knows only two kinds of societies, the Islamic and the Jahili. The Islamic society is that which follows Islam in beliefs and ways of worship, law, organization, morals, and manners. Jahili society is that which does not follow Islam, and in which neither Islamic belief and concepts or values or standards, laws, regulations, morals, manners are cared for. It's a very black and white world. You're either in the one world, which is civilized, or you're in the Jahili world, which is the world of unbelief. It's just my conviction. And I'm with this guy, Carl Raschke. The only way Christianity can hope to succeed against Islam is to put aside the secularist project altogether. In other words, the only response to Islam is not governments, in a way. It's not military force. It's not economic power. It's not political structures. It's not a drone campaign. Not ultimately, it can't be. The reason Raschke says the secularist project has to be put away is because only Christianity has a comprehensive view of life that is greater than that Islam offers. Islam grows because it is a comprehensive organism. The only thing that can compete with it is a Christianity that goes back to rediscovering its own roots. Okay, our end game. This is Çetin and his wife. Çetin is a Muslim convert from Turkey who is now pastoring a church in Izmir, ancient Smyrna. the city of my ancestors. So he came out of Islam, came to Christ, and he's now leading other Muslims to Christ. Yippee. We have to understand Islam's pre-modern identity. We've talked about that an awful lot yesterday and today. You really have to get to the roots of what it is. In practical terms, we have to stop repeating the mistakes of our ancestors. Our ancestors eventually wore the mantle of dhimmi people. They became subject people. People that allowed themselves to be in this protection racket. We can't afford to do that. We have to learn how to be sensitive to the Muslim in such a way that when Muslims take the initiative, as they did with the common word, we have a wiser response than we did. We weren't wise. We lacked wisdom. But if we really know who they are and we know who we're supposed to be, then we won't fall for it. We will respond to them, but we won't respond to them in the same way. I mean, at the very least, we would have recognized common word came from a surah that was anti-Christian. And that meant agreeing to their agreement was agreeing with an anti-Christian statement. That's not a good idea, is it? We would have known that wasn't a good idea. Then we would have offered a counteroffer, and our counteroffer would have promoted our own faith, not theirs. Take the evangelistic initiative no matter what. That means aggressive outreach into the Muslim world no matter what it takes. And I don't mean no matter what it costs Bengalis or Pakistanis. I mean, we actually have to come to grips with that we've assumed an identity as American Christians, as non-suffering Christians. And that's almost a contradiction in terms. I'm laughing. It's not really funny. If you look at the Bible itself, you realize that the idea of a Christian that doesn't suffer, there really isn't a model for that. I mean, we don't have it in the Bible. We made it ourselves. So resuming that identity will mean we have to put our money where our mouth is. And that will mean aggressively pursuing the Muslim world with the gospel, no matter what it takes, no matter where it means we have to go. It will mean working much more closely with Muslim converts that are already taking those risks. It depends on where you are. Yeah, depends on where you are. It can be death. It can be imprisonment. It can be voiding your marriage contracts or taking your kids out of school. There are loads of confiscating property, depending on what country you're in. There are always a cost to the witness. I guess my point is that Christians in America aren't really there until we ourselves are even willing to pay that kind of price for faith, to see the gospel promoted. It'll also mean something that's harder. There's something harder than suffering yourself. And that is asking, and people that are in the military that have been in combat know this. The hardest thing is not going into it yourself. The hardest thing is telling someone else to. Knowing that that person may lose his or her life, all that they have, is not easy to do. But we have to be willing to go with them. We have to be willing to support their going. I see no other alternative. I don't see any easy way to take the gospel into Muslim cultures. If Muslims are committed people and committed to the promotion of their faith and their way of life, if we are less committed to promoting the same, we do not win. And we never have. It's never been true in the history of the world that Christianity grew away apart from that. We only grew, I mean, if you really want to get elemental about this, the only reason Christianity grew was because we went where Jesus took us. And in the Bible, over and over again, in Hebrews chapter 12, for example, we follow Jesus in our suffering. We go where he takes us, and he doesn't take us to easy places. So I guess what I'm saying as Christians is we actually need to come closer to our brothers and sisters in Muslim countries that are already risking everything. We have to be like they are. Then we can confront Islam in a gospel kind of way. I'm an advocate for self-defense, don't get me wrong. But when I go into a Muslim country, I'm not going with a gun. But I am promoting the gospel faith, no matter what, in the face of Islam, regardless of consequence. Because I know of no other way for those people to come to know the Lord. And I also know on the basis of my own experience that when they come to the Lord, it's an amazing thing, and God uses them in an amazing way to reach more Muslims. They become an army of witnesses. I told someone earlier that in March 2000, a lot of my motivation comes from, believe it or not, a dream I had in March 2000, and in my dream, I dreamed that the next Reformation would come to the West through Muslim converts that brought us the gospel. That still is, by the way. It still is. I'll give you one anecdote. In Indonesia, 7 years ago, the number of Christians in Indonesia rose for the first time in 40 years. The numbers were attributed to two things only. One, Indonesian Christians that had been Muslims converted to Christianity were immigrating into Netherlands. That was one reason. The other reason was that these immigrants were witnessing to Dutch people. And little by little, they were also coming to Christ. I have a friend in outside of Paris who's a French intellectual, so as I say, he's usually depressed. French intellectuals do two things, that smoke cigarettes, Christians, it doesn't matter. They smoke cigarettes and they're depressed. That's what they do. So he called me up, I was in London at the time, and he depressed me because he couldn't reach Frenchmen with the gospel. And I said, are you telling me that nobody is reaching the French in Paris with the gospel anywhere? And he thought about it for a second. He said, well, yeah, no, that's not really true. I mean, there's a church of Africans from Cameroon. I said, so what's going on there? He said, well, several hundred people have come to Christ in this church. And I said, are they Cameroonians? And he said, no, that was just the original. That was the little core group that started this church. So who are all these other people? He said, well, they're Frenchmen. I said, So what you're saying is you're depressed because you can't reach them. You're not depressed because God can't. God's doing it a lot. So my picture in my head of the world is God is reaching unprecedented numbers of Muslims with the gospel. And they are reaching one another with the gospel. But my dream is that God brings so many people to Christ that they also bring us back to the gospel. And would that be a bad thing? I don't think so. Practice self-defense against dawah. Now, I meant that in two ways. One, we recognize dawah. In other words, a common word is dawah. Once we understand it as dawah, then we can respond to it appropriately as Christians. And the second way is more literal. If I'm in a Muslim country, I do think you do have a right to self-defense. That's a tricky business. That's a tricky business. I mean, the places where this is becoming the most contested and difficult problem is in Nigeria. Because Nigeria was 90% Muslim at the beginning of the last century is now 50-50. 50% Muslim, 50% Christian. You have an active terrorism campaign by one of the most radically Muslim groups in the world. And it's targeting churches and Christians deliberately. Christians in Nigeria are having to figure out, how do we respond to this threat? More probably than anywhere else, the Christians are saying we need to defend ourselves against Muslim threat, physical threat, but we need to do it in an appropriate way so we're not mounting our own terrorism campaigns. So they're actually having to think through the issue, what do we do? It's a 50-50 society. There are people that are killing us. We don't believe in killing in the name of our faith. So how do we respond? Do we take guns and defend our villages? Do we not take up arms and let them kill us? What do we do? Now, this problem is going to become a bigger problem, because as more and more Muslims convert to Christianity, you will see more of this. And that means that those young Christian communities are going to have to figure out how to respond. That makes sense? Tough problem. Exploit cultural fault lines in Islam. That's not too hard to figure out. Islam came out of an Arabic context, but the vast majority of Muslims in the world don't live in the Arabic world. The vast minority do. About 20-25% of Muslims in the world are Arabs. The largest Muslim country in the world is Indonesia. The second largest as of now is India. The third largest is Pakistan, and the fourth largest is Bangladesh. If you look at all of those countries, none of them are Arabic. The Muslim faith was layered on top of Hinduism, basically. That's interesting because it creates fault lines. There are points of tension where Islam is not fully accepted on the same basis. In other words, to be a Muslim is not synonymous with being a Bengali. It's a little different. It's my thinking that creates an opportunity for Christians, particularly Muslim background Christians working right from within that culture. There's a very large movement to Christ. I would say probably mostly through the Assemblies of God in Iran. And that's coming because Iranians are not Arabics. They're not Arabs. They're anti-Arabs. It's like matter to antimatter. I mean, no Iranian likes an Arab, I know. There's actually a 1% minority of Arabs in Iran, and they're a persecuted minority. Farsi has a few Arabic loanwords, that's about it. But there is an undying animosity between Arabs and Iranians. It shouldn't be a great surprise, then, that the Christian church grows in Iran better than it does in most other parts of the Muslim world. Now, my point, though, is there's a lot of those places. Like Indonesia, where there's a large church planting movement taking place. Bangladesh is another example. So I think Christians need to exploit those fault lines. We need to be offensive minded without being offensive people. And the most important thing I've said for 2 days now is learn to put away our fear. When I came back for the first time after 9/11, and I was in London at 9/11, so Cheryl and I watched it on TV when I came home for lunch. So it happened in the morning here. It happened right at lunchtime there. I saw it. A month later, I was in the States. So I had to go through those long, long lines in Atlanta. You know, the security had all been beefed up. And I had to go and buy a suit at a discount place in Atlanta area, and they had a talk radio on. And there was a level of hysteria that I had never heard in my lifetime. And I'm not that young anymore. It was fear. And as I visited churches on my visit, I heard fear from the Christians to a degree to which I had never heard before. And I have to say, now, all these years later, I'm still hearing it. Christians, like other Americans, are characterized by their fear. It's a strange thing. We're like in some areas, we're the most advanced country in the whole world. In some ways, we have more freedoms than anywhere else in the world, and we're the most afraid. Those things just don't line up very well for me. And when you layer on top of that the idea that we're Christians, I don't really get it. Why should we be afraid? If we have a promise from God, then what's our fear based on? If we don't believe the promises that God gives us about what he's doing in this world, but we do take counsel of our fears, then we're not worshiping the God that gave us the promises, we're worshiping the thing that we fear. You need to consider that. Now, when you go to church tomorrow, you won't think like that. But the rest of the week, you might start thinking like that. You need to look at that and just say, that's the kind of thing that gets me nowhere. Okay, that's the end of this. We can take a break and head on into the next area when you get back.